Hello, and welcome to another exciting episode of Batman Nightcast, a proud part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm Ryan Daly.
And I'm Chris Franklin.
And on this podcast, we review the comic book adventures of the Dark Knight Detective and sometimes his partner, Robin the Boy Wonder. This episode, we're wrapping up the classic Black Mask trilogy, and we're hitting the three-quarters mark of Batman and Robin Year One with our coverage of the ninth issue of that series.
Before we get to that, we want to give a big shout-out to our Patreon sponsor for this episode, J. David Weider. If you want to be awesome like Dave, consider supporting Batman Nightcast or any other show on the Fire and Water Podcast Network at patreon.com/FWPodcasts.
All right, Chris, what is going on in the world of Batman before we get to our comics?
I don't really think much of nothing's going on with Batman, is there? I mean... No, there's a lot of Batman news, like, you know, and in fact, as we record this, just yesterday, there was more news about the Batman Part 2, the Matt Reeves movie.
It must be coming out soon, right? We've been talking about it forever.
Well, you would think, and you would also think because a Superman movie is also being filmed at the same time right now, and it's coming out next year. And what has more special effects in it? Let's see. But no, The Batman Part 2 is not coming out now until February of 2028.
Or so they say.
Or so they say. Hey, we did get some footage. We got footage of Robert Pattinson as Batman turning around and looking at the camera as the score from the first film played. So the Michael Giacchino.
And it looks like either snow or ash kind of falling around there.
Yes, and his ears are longer.
Yes, so. I liked that. I did like that.
Yeah, I did too, yeah. And other than that, there's probably some small details that are different, but it's the same kind of look for the mask. I mean, it looks good. He looks good, you know. I'm very eager to see another film in this series, but it's just, we're going to have to be very patient. I don't know why in the hell they can crank out a Superman or Superman-related movie once a year, but we can't. It takes 6-7 years to get a Batman movie. I have no idea, but there you go.
It's not like that's a valuable property. There's no reason why they would want to, like, you know, speed that up.
No, and I did hear, like, one, and this could be completely baseless, but one YouTuber I follow said, you know, he'd heard the rumors, and he didn't say that he had any inside info, but he'd heard rumblings that there's going to be an announcement at San Diego Comic-Con about the DC Universe, James Gunn, Batman, you know, what they're doing with Batman there. Like, who's going to play Batman? There's going to be some kind of announcement at San Diego Comic-Con, which, as we record this, is next week.
Right.
Now, whether that's true or not, and he didn't claim that that was going to happen. He just said he'd heard rumblings about it. And that might be one reason why they wanted to get ahead of this and say, okay, it's been delayed, but here's some footage so you know that there's actually this Batman coming, so you don't get confused. But I guarantee you people are going to get confused. So I don't really see the point in having two different live-action Batman and film franchises at the same time, but what do I know? So I don't.
We live in confusing times. Why should Batman be any different?
Good point. Good point.
Also in the realm of the DC movies, on the last episode, we were optimistic about Supergirl. That was coming out right after we did that episode. At this point, we have seen the movie. What did you think?
I liked it. I did like it. I had heard some reviews from people that I am friends with, that I trusted, and that they didn't seem too high on it. So I came in with low expectations, I guess, in some ways, but I liked it. I don't think it's perfect. I don't think it's, I think there's some problems with it. And I think we've since learned that there might've been way too many cooks in the kitchen.
Yeah.
and which is kind of disturbing that, you know, it's like, can James Gunn not at least puppet direct any of these movies? Could he stay out of them? I don't know. But I liked it. I liked Millie Alcock. You know, I had to get over the fact that this is how the direction they're going with the character. But again, I felt in the last episode, I feel like it's a better choice to do it in a film where she's not previously established otherwise. This is how this character is. It makes more sense in that universe. And I think they juxtaposed her against, you know, Corn Sweat Superman real well. She was good. She was great in it, actually. And, you know, I thought, you know, Momoa was fine as Lobo. I don't think he was, you know, he was basically a glorified cameo, and he didn't really do a whole lot. Honestly, he could have been not in the film, and it wouldn't have affected anything, I don't think, really. But, you know, he was fine. And I thought the villain, I did agree with most people that the villain in the version we saw was kind of, you know, he was very, the villains were very disgusting and deplorable. And I know they were trying to make the like him seem like kind of creepy cool, but he just, I don't know. I never bought the threat of him despite who he was and what he was doing. I don't know. I didn't think he was like, I don't know. He was over, his visual was overdone and the character underdelivered to me. That was probably the weakest point for me. But overall, I liked it. I hate that it cratered like it did. Because I just for multiple reasons, but it is what it is. But what did you think of it?
I did not like it that much. I didn't hate it, but I didn't really like it that much. Now, I thought Millie Alcock was great. I thought she as Supergirl, she's fun, even though I didn't necessarily want drunk, depressed Supergirl, but I thought she did a great job, and I still like her at the end of the movie, and I'm looking forward to seeing her continue in this DC universe, the other movies, especially the next Superman one that's coming out next year. So I thought she was good, and I left the movie thinking, I want to see more of her. But the rest of the movie, I was kind of meh. Now, we've talked about it before. Part of it is the source material, the story that this is based on, I'm not a huge fan of. And they did make certain changes, but I don't think the changes were any real improvements. I did think the bad guy was utterly forgettable. In fact, I was struggling to remember his name up until, 10 seconds ago. I like kind of what they were going for, that they were, you know, without so much as saying it, they're basically, it's a sex trafficking ring, and she's going and breaking this up and taking these guys down, these bad guys. And I was like, yeah, I get that, but they also just kind of look like the generic Reavers, Marauders, whatever, from Guardians or something like that, or Mad Max. They don't really have much personality or anything memorable. And then Lobo looks kind of the same as them. The reason to put Lobo in this story is to do what Tom King originally wanted, is to have him be the salty, cynical bounty hunter guy and Supergirl be the wide-eyed one who hires him. But they didn't do that. They kept the thing as the Woman of Tomorrow story, that relationship with Supergirl and this other girl. And then they brought Lobo in, but he didn't achieve anything, and I know, like, everybody was like, yeah, Jason Momoa is the right guy. Jason Momoa was, like, perfect for Lobo. I was like, okay, but based on what they gave him to do, I didn't see anything really interesting. Now, part of that is I don't think the character of Lobo is all that interesting. I kind of joked in our group. I was like, as much as I didn't like him playing Aquaman, he was at least interesting as Aquaman, and I didn't find him very interesting as Lobo. So take that for whatever it is. I thought, like, just kind of all of the planets looked the same. They all looked very drab and gray, and all of the costumes were drab and gray. They kept having little things. I was like, oh, that's cool. I wonder if they'll do with that. And then I found they didn't do it, or I didn't like what they did it. And yeah, it just ultimately there was a lot of stuff that I was just, all right, this isn't really what I want from this movie. Based on the story's own internal logic, the story was fine. It made sense for what they were trying to tell. So I wish more viewers gave that a chance. And I think it should have been more successful at the box office. But it just, yeah, I couldn't really say that I liked it. So.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I just don't think anybody loves this movie. It doesn't even seem to have anybody really championing it. You know, it's like, no, this movie is great. It's like, you're not getting it. It's like this. It's like, no, nobody's really doing that. You know, it's like, it's just kind of like, yeah, it was, you know, there was such a humongous push for it and so many merchandise tie-ins and things. It was kind of like, it made it even worse. You know, if it just been kind of pushed out there and not had done well, but it was like, yeah, and And a lot of people were like, oh, is this being the DCU's doomed? It's like their second movie and it's tanked. And it's like, yeah, well, it's not good. You know, that's never a good thing. But it's like, you know, we'll see how, you know, Clayface and, you know, based on how horror's doing right now, I feel like Clayface could be a humongous hit.
Sure,
you know,
yeah.
It could. It might not be, but it could be. It's probably got more of a chance of being a hit than Supergirl ever did, honestly.
Very likely.
Yeah, and you know, hopefully Man of Tomorrow will, you know, bring people back in. And we found out that Blue Beetle's coming back in Man of Tomorrow, which is cool. I actually really liked that film. That was and I like the actor that plays him. And Solo, is that the kid's name?
I think so. I didn't see Blue Beetle. I haven't seen that movie yet. So.
Oh, really? That's fun. It's a lot of fun. Yeah, he's great, and his family. Him and his family are what makes the movie. The villain is played by Susan Sarandon, and she's kind of forgettable, but. It's a fun movie. I enjoyed it, so I'm glad to see he's continuing on. But it's like, man, how many, again, you got Blue Beetle in that movie. That's another effect. And it's like, again, we're still getting that before the Batman part two. I'll quit griping. I get it. It's Supergirl's just kind of, you know, it's nobody. I hate to say this. We'll get a listener that'll say, it's my favorite movie. It just seems like it's nobody's favorite movie. You know, it didn't ignite any kind of passion in the fan base, which is a shame. Because, like we said, I think Millie Alcock was great in it. And I wanted it to succeed just to rub it in, like we said, rub it in the face of people who were awful and mean about her appearance. And just, you know, people who can't let go of previous versions of the DC universe that are dead and buried, and you need to get over it. And but anyway, it is what it is. So I don't think Hollywood understands what the hell is going on. All sorts of movies that should have been blockbusters aren't making anybody, and then these little tiny independent horror movies made by YouTubers are making millions and millions of dollars. So, you know,
we contribute to that. I actually saw Obsession. I rented it a few nights ago, and I liked it a lot.
Yeah, I really like that one. I was talking to my daughter-in-law about it, and she finally got to see it, and we were talking about it, and we were the only two in the family that got to see it, and she's like, it didn't, like, people were telling me it's going to, like, scare me to death. It's like, it didn't scare me, like, but it disturbed me.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yes, that's it. It's like, it's not jumps. There's a couple parts that are kind of jump scary, but it's more like a creeping dread of, ooh, this is wrong.
Right, you know, right.
It's just so uncomfortable and wrong, but still entertaining somehow. I don't know how they did that, but it's still very entertaining. Yeah, that's great. I haven't seen Backrooms. Danny did, and she thought it was pretty good. She wasn't like, she's like, you know, it was, I don't know if it quite lived up to the hype for her. I haven't seen Backrooms, but Obsession definitely lived up to the hype for me. I thought it, you know, it was.
And that actress, Indy Navarrete, she's going to blow up. She's going to be big. Like, I don't know what she's going to do next. But.
Yeah. And I kind of felt like when she was on Superman and Lois, I felt like she was a cut above the rest of the young cast on that show even then. And so, you know, sometimes those actors do get the opportunity to get something that they blow up in, and sometimes they don't. But I kind of felt like she had that potential. Like, she was kind of above the, I shouldn't say above the material, because I'll get, you know, Michael Bailey will come hunt me down and beat me. but because I like Superman Lois, it's a great show. But no, she was just like kind of a cut above the other, and all the actors on there are actually pretty good, the kid actors. But she just, there was something about her. And so, I hope she goes on to great things. She's, you know, she is, the movie would not work nearly as well if she wasn't so terrific in it. So,
right.
She's the good chunk of that movie, portraying that character that can flip on a dime. I don't want to say too much, but yeah, you've all seen the bits where she loses it and then like snaps back, and yeah, it's amazing how she does that. It's a tour de force, that's for sure.
Oh, other Batman news. In other media, the second season of Amazon Prime's Batman the Caped Crusader comes out probably a week after this episode comes out, July 31st. So that should be cool. I'm still looking forward to that. Again, the first season really blew me away and surprised me. This next season, we're going to be getting a bunch of his rogues. So we'll see how they interpret guys like Two-Face and Scarecrow and Joker and these guys.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. The trailer looks great. There's an aspect of it that I saw a little image from it the other day that's not in the trailer that my son Andrew told me about, and I was kind of intrigued by that. I don't want to say what it is in case people don't want to be spoiled, but I was like, oh, how's that work? But it's you know, they're daring to, you know, I know they did some things last year that people are last, when was it, two, 3 years? How many years has it been? A year or two ago now? I can't remember, but the last time they did some, you know, gender swaps and things that got people all upset. But I felt within the universe at work, it doesn't bother me, man. There's so many different versions of Batman. It's like, do what you want. I don't care. You know, let's just make it interesting, you know, and they have. So I'm really looking forward to that. We're got an embarrassment of TV, you know, with the X-Men 97 right now, and that's good. And Cape Crusader coming back, and My Adventures with Superman's been good, and the last episode was really great on that one. So it's an embarrassment of TV animation riches right at the moment.
What else? We got some comic stuff to talk about and some action figure stuff. What do you want to do?
Well, we can talk real briefly. You know, the Mattel, the core DC Core figures, which are their play line, more or less, you know, for directed toward play for kids. But they're out, and they've definitely enticed the collectors to sample them, because it's kind of a preview of what they're going to do with their collector line, which should be previewed at San Diego Comic-Con, which, as we said, is next week as we record this. These figures are great. I picked up the Robin, which is kind of sort of based on the Dan Mora Dick Grayson Robin redesign, although he does have Tim Drake's symbol on this figure, but it's very close to that. And then two very great friends of mine, including somebody on this mic and another guy named David Ace Gutierrez, sent me the Batman and the Flash from that line, and they are a whole lot of fun. The sculpting is great on these. They come with a ton of accessories that kids are going to lose instantly. carpets are going to eat. It's like when I was a kid and I'd get a G.I. Joe figure and I'd start opening the car, and mom's like, don't open it in the car, you'll lose all the guns. You know, it's kind of that same thing.
That happened to me. That did happen to me.
Oh, yeah, it happened to me too. I lost all sorts of stuff down in the car. They've got a ton of, you know, different batarangs and grapple guns and accessories, and they come with a little stand you can pop together and put them on, and they're really great. And I know they've released several other 2-packs and 3-packs that are coming out, and the only thing is that, like, a lot of collectors are like, they don't have ankle articulation, they don't have, you know, butterfly joints, they, you know, different things like that. But, I mean, beyond all that, they're still super poseable, and they're really well done. They're solid. They feel like a solid, you know, playable action figure. And if they take that and then plus it for the collector line, I mean, it's going to be great. Plus, these are like $12.99, like, you know, they're like 13 yeah. bucks or lower. It's insane.
That's the only reason I got them for you.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Yeah. Yeah. No,
if they were $40, I would have been like, sorry, Chris.
Yeah. No, it's like, you know, they're great. I mean, it's the value is insane. I mean, it's just nuts. And I hope they keep the collector line at least in the range of the, I'm sure they will, like the Marvel Legend range, which of course keeps going up. But they're fantastic. And I'm looking forward to seeing what else I know they've got a lot of Batman-centric stuff. You know, they've got a Nightwing, I think Batman Nightwing Bane set, and then it's weird. It's like you mentioned it, I think, in our one of our chats, but it's, was it Batman, Mr. Freeze, and Hal Jordan? Which is like, what? When did that happen? Yeah, but no, they're a lot of fun. So if you're on the fence about them, I mean, one, it's 13 bucks. You can't even get a freaking combo meal at a fast food joint for that hardly anymore. You know, buy a figure and take it home, play with it, and set it up on your desk and have fun with it and try them out. But I'm really stoked about them. And so, yeah.
Very cool. Very cool. For some comic book stuff, last month, I went back to my hometown in Illinois and visited my old hometown comic book store, took advantage of some sales and got a bunch of DC trade paperbacks. So I read the first volume of the current Batman run by Matt Fraction and Jorge Jimenez. It's good. It's good. I don't like the redesigned costume with the blue bat signal. I think the single tone bat signal, whether it's black or blue or yellow or something, when it's just that one tone, I think it misses something. I think you have to break it up a little bit with the oval or something else like that. I think that really does work. But aside from that little nitpick, good book, very interesting storyline. It seems like it's building upon a lot of ideas. Like it's not like one 6-issue story arc. It seems like each issue is somewhat self-contained while still building to other pieces. Because it's a Matt Fraction comic, one of the issues is just a car chase. It's just Bruce Wayne driving his car and as he's being chased by ninjas. And so I was like, yeah, of course, that sounds like something Matt Fraction has done several times, but he does it really well. But more than that book, what I discovered to my surprise was the most recent, and I say past tense because it was recently canceled or the book has ended, but the Batman and Robin comic, which has Bruce and Damian Wayne as Robin, and we know how much you love Damian Wayne. I keyed into it because the writer for the last couple of, the last 17 issues was Philip Kennedy Johnson, who's one of my favorite artists at DC. He was doing Action Comics for a long time before Mark Waid. Like, he did the big War World saga and then some other stuff. He also did like a 12-issue Green Lantern maxi series with Jon Stewart. So I was like, all right, he's writing Batman and Robin. Let me give it a shot. And he does something really cool with Damian, which I think you would appreciate.
He kills him? No, I'm sorry.
No, but he...
I'm just kidding.
So here's the thing. You could say he's writing the wrong character because he doesn't write Damian the way that everybody else has written Damian, which is to be an asshole. Damian is a wretched, arrogant, entitled, uptight, bratty asshole.
Yeah.
Johnson doesn't write him that way. And you could say that he's changing the character. He's not doing it right. But he's writing Tim Drake, but calling him Damian. But he kind of comes up with an in-story reason for that. Because the whole thing, like, the shadow looming over Damian, what has always informed that asshole persona of his, is that he is not just the son of Batman. He's the grandson of Ra's al Ghul. Mm-hmm. And he was trained in Ra's al Ghul's philosophy and that study of the League of Assassins. So he has this very pessimistic, almost fatalistic impression of humanity. And he's fighting back his impulses to just be superior to them at all times. And that's kind of the way he's always been. And that's why he's a hard character to like. But what Johnson does kind of in the first story in his run is kind of say, remind him, the character, is like, you're not just Ra's al Ghul's grandson, you're Thomas Wayne's grandson. And Thomas Wayne was a healer, a doctor who did these other things. So Damian starts reading Thomas Wayne's old diaries and medical journals and really kind of flips something in Damian. And he goes on this kind of more path to maturity and starts questioning the purpose of Batman and Robin in a way that he's never asked before, and whether what they're doing is right, if there's a life for him as Damian Wayne and not just Damian Batman. It's an interesting take on the character, which is very different than the way he's always been presented. So I think if you gave it a shot, you'd be like, okay, I can deal with this Damian. Now the problem is that series has been canceled and I don't know if we'll see that continue. But Ella.
Oh, that sounds intriguing. I like that. Yeah. I might have to give that a shot. I've been getting the Batman series. I'm way behind reading it. It's it's stacking up. It's my new comic reading is I've been reading a lot of old comics and stuff, and I've just I haven't caught up to the new stuff, but I've enjoyed it. But yeah, I'm with you on the I don't really care. I mean, I don't hate the new costume design. It's just kind of, you know, like, I don't know. It's just kind of like they didn't change. I don't want them to change it any more than that. But at the same time, it's like, why don't you just go back to the Oval at this point? Other than Batman Incorporated in a few things that hasn't been used in years, it'd be different, you know, just to have it back, you know. But yeah, that take on Damian sounds like, you know, I like that. I like that he's, you know, because, you know, as a kid, sometimes you kind of do like, well, these are the relatives I've been around, but what were my other relatives like? And you kind of start exploring your family history, and you kind of pick that up and get into it, and that's an, especially considering, you know, who his grandfather is. And I'm assuming Thomas Wayne in this iteration isn't the you know, kind of the brusque you know, dad that, you know, yells at Bruce every chance he gets. He's no. Probably yeah. a little more of the Batman Begins type Thomas Wayne, right? Who's like actually a nice person, you know. So
he was going to make a paper boat to sail down the river with Bruce before he died.
Oh, okay, yeah, that's good. I prefer that Thomas Wayne, you know. Yeah. So
anyway, we should probably get into the topic du jour of this episode.
Yeah, yeah. Why don't we? Yeah. So that is Batman number 386 that was cover dated, let's see, September 1985. On the cover by Tom Mandrake, a shocked Batman removes the black mask from the face of Roman Sionis as the two struggle in a blazing fire. So what do you think of this one?
I like this cover. Of the three covers of the series, this is my favorite cover.
Okay.
I think Batman's look of shock is attention-getting. It's shocking because that's not a look we're used to seeing on Batman. He doesn't usually get you know, taken by surprise that way. It's a little bit maybe misleading because it suggests that we know that Roman isn't scarred or disfigured at this point, so that look of shock would only come if, like, he's surprised that he recognizes who's under the mask. But that's not really the mystery.
No.
And the other thing, and we might kind of get into it as we go along, but I just wanted to mention it here before I forget. The way that Mandrake draws Roman's face, like in the previous issue and then in this one, like when he's not masked, there's a kind of plainness, but also a sort of roundness of the cheeks and kind of narrowness of the eyes. He reminded me of an actor, and I couldn't think of who it was. But I was like, it's got to be somebody kind of contemporary. And I finally realized who he reminds me of. And this may sound crazy. You might not agree with this. But it's an actor named Jerry Levine or Levine. He was Michael J. Fox's friend in Teen Wolf. He played Styles.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you remember that guy who did like the surfing on the roof or something?
Yeah.
There's something about like his face reminds me of like when I look at Roman Sionis, the way Mandrake draws him, I see that actor.
Okay. Yeah, I remember thinking he was kind of like Ray Milan, the classic golden age of Hollywood actor.
Yeah,
but I can see that. Yeah, I mean, and that, you know, he probably would have had more possibility to base it on him than Ray Milan in a lot of ways. So, I can see that. Yeah, and this, I like this cover. I think the cover, the drawing is good. Everything's solid. I do feel like you're not really catching the heat, the coloring. It's very, you know, Batman's in blues and grays, and it's not, when we get inside, you know, Adrian Roy is the colorist, as always, and she does a fantastic job of making it feel like those pages are actually on fire when you're reading it, and this doesn't, but they might have wanted to not have Batman, they might have wanted to have Batman in his classic colors on the cover to help sell the book to, you know, kids, because that's back when we were still trying to sell comic books to kids, so that might be part of it, so. But yeah, otherwise I think it's a solid cover. So the story is Eben Maskery. Doug Minch was the writer, Tom Mandrake the artist, John Costanza the letterer, Adrian Roy, as we mentioned, was the colorist, and Len Wein was the editor. In the Batcave, the Caped Crusader and the Boy Wonder examine the invitations created by Alfred, which read, Eben Maskery, an evening of dark disguise at Wayne Manor, Friday, June 6th, 8 p.m. Leave your true face behind, RSVP. Robin points out that it's an obvious trap, but Batman insists that Black Mask won't be able to resist. His thirst for vengeance against the Wayne Foundation for taking over his company, Janus Cosmetics, and his belief that his new identity as Black Mask makes Roman Sionis think he's invincible. In the Sionis family crypt, Black Mask also ponders the invitation, and although he knows it's a trap, he plans to spring it, believing Wayne never intended for him to actually appear. Black Mask must pick another visage for the party and chooses a disguise combining the famous drama and comedy masks. Later at the party, Bruce and Alfred try to suss out who is who under the various disguises. Bruce is shocked that the muscular woman he approaches is his old and very jaded lover, Vicky Vale. Alfred deduces a man wearing a familiar raccoon mask is the banker Herbert Stevens and believes Sionis in his dramedy mask is a man named Marconi. An undercover detective Harvey Bullock, dressed appropriately as a baboon, stalks and unmasks Cersei. When he sees her hideously scarred face, he thinks she is just wearing another mask underneath. The man everyone believes is Stevens asks to see Bruce's conservatory, but Alfred finds the real Stevens unconscious, possibly dead, wearing the dramedy mask. Bruce quickly realizes that the raccoon masked man he is with is really Sionis, who unmasks and pulls a gun on him. Bruce kicks and punches him away, but he topples a rare statue on Bruce and flees. Robin goes into action and tells Sionis back to his family crypt and calls Batman for backup. Entering the cemetery, the dynamic duo are besieged by members of the False Face Society. They make quick work of them and find Black Mask waiting in one of his parents' coffins. He then escapes through a false bottom outside to his waiting hearse. They follow via the Batmobile to the Sionis estate, where Black Mask plans to burn the last vestiges of Roman Sionis, completing his transformation into his new identity. As Batman and Robin make it through another gauntlet of false facers, Black Mask sets fire to Roman's childhood home and all of his toys. He opens the door in triumph, having purged his past, but is dismayed to learn his society has fallen before the masked manhunter. He runs back into the blazing room, a bat rope ensnaring his legs as the burning ceiling collapses on him. Batman uses his cape to lift the beam, and Robin pulls their foe to safety. Batman removes his disguise to reveal that Sionis has succeeded. His face is now charred like the ebony disguise he created. With Sionis in custody, our heroes confer with Commissioner Gordon and Bullock at GCPD headquarters. Some of the False Face Society members are still at large, but Batman is convinced they will be easily caught without their leader. As for Cersei, Batman thinks she'll be content to continue hiding behind her mask. But at Arkham Asylum, she drops her disguise off as a present for her incarcerated former lover and walks away, her true face showing. So how's that for an ending?
Some stuff happened. I like that. I like when stuff happens.
Yeah.
I like this chapter. I like this conclusion. We talked about the previous issue of Batman. The first chapter of this was a great little origin story for the Black Mask character and finding out everything about this Roman Sionis character and how dark and twisted and broken he is. That was a great intro. But the lack of Batman kind of like held it back a little bit for me. This time we get the fulfillment. We get the action. We see Batman going up against Black Mask. We see Bruce Wayne going up against Roman and kind of more or less their civilian identities. Yeah, there was a lot about this that I liked. There's a few silly parts. And of course, naturally there always are. And we'll go through those. But overall, I enjoyed this as the concluding chapter.
Yeah, I liked it. I think the first part was still the best because, you know, this was a good ending, but it did seem a little anticlimactic to me, and we'll get into that. I think they overpromised a bit much with how great Black Mask was going to be, comparing him to the Joker and Ra's al Ghul, you know? he did end up having legs, of course, but that version of Black Mask is barely recognizable to this version in a lot of ways. But, you know,
yeah.
But overall, I think it was a solid ending. I will say this comic was pretty influential on me. I created a hero called The Mask when I was in, you know, like probably late elementary, early middle school, who wore the exact comedy drama combo mask that we see on the invitation and on Sionis later in the story, even in those exact red and white colors. He wore a red fedora, trench coat, and a suit, so he was definitely inspired or ripped off by a combination of this and The Question.
Nice.
But this was before the mask character that was made famous by the Jim Carrey
movie. The
Dark Horse Comics Mark Verheiden character. This was before that. So yeah, I took inspiration from this and created my own superhero, or, you know, crime fighter. He was edgy. He used guns. You know, he was an anti-hero. You know, it was all that. And, you know, even though I never was a huge fan of anti-heroes as much as some people have, for whatever reason. But yeah, that was my inspiration. So
that's cool.
I like the dichotomy that Mitch and Mandrake use in the beginning, because we get two splashes, one in the Batcave, one in the Sionis Crypt. Then page three has the heroes on the left-hand column of panels and the villains on the right-hand column. Then on page four, it's heroes on the top row and villains in the bottom. It drives home that mirror image aspect of Black Mask to Batman, which there's no shortage of mirror image characters to Batman, but... Because around this time we got the Wrath, and then we'll get Prometheus later, and, you know, so blah, blah, blah. So, yeah, but...
Phantasm.
Phantasm, obviously, yeah, yeah. So, and the Reaper, we already had the Reaper, so, yeah, yeah. So, so how did you think that? Did you like the way they broke up those scenes?
I did. Structurally, I liked that, because we got the exposition out of that, and, like, it's basically these two parallel scenes right before kind of like the action picks up with the party, the masquerade. So I did like the way those were divided, and instead of just giving two pages to Batman talking to Robin and Alfred, and then two pages of Black Mask talking to his goons and basically conveying the same info from two different perspectives, actually having them like mirrored or paralleled that way and kind of jumping back between them. I did think that was kind of really effective. The thing I didn't like, and it's fine, but by now, of course, it's kind of a cliche, but and maybe it wasn't as bad in the 1980s when this came out, but like the whole thing of is, well, this is obviously a trap. Exactly. That's why it's going to work. It's like, what the hell does that mean? And like Cersei and everybody are like, boss, you know this is a trap. And he's like, yeah, but I'm smarter than them. I'll walk right into the trap and win. It's like, okay, all right. Like, I know Batman is saying he'll fall for it because he's so arrogant and so hell-bent on revenge, and he doesn't see himself as Roman anymore. He's really the Black Mask. Like, Batman, how do you know this yet? You haven't really interacted with this guy that much yet. You may be spot on, but that seems like the writer imposing this something knowledge that maybe Batman shouldn't have. And I just kind of like, when I kind of wanted Cersei to do the thing, in like Austin Powers, when Dr. Evil's son, Scott, when he's just kind of like, why are you leaving him in the death trap and then walking away? Why don't you just kill him right now? You can be sure he's dead. And it's like, no, this is how we'll do it. We'll just leave him there. I'll just assume that the sharks will eat him. It's like, I've got a gun. You can just shoot him and then there's no question.
We can do it together. Yeah.
Yeah, we can do it. It'll be fun. And Cersei, I just wanted to be like, don't walk into the trap. You might mess up.
Yeah, it would be nice to see. Yeah, I mean, I know that in Austin Powers, like you said, they're lampooning that whole bit, you know.
Right.
But it's like, I would be like, the Goldfinger walks away when James Bond is strapped down with the laser coming out his crotch, right? You know, it's or all the death traps on Batman, they never stayed around and watched, right? At least in the same room. I'd like to see somebody in a Batman comic be like, no, I'm not springing this trap. And then, you know, Bruce throws this lavish party and no villain shows up, and it's just some boring ass party that he's got to sit through, never becoming Batman. Jason's stuck up in his room in his Robin costume, you know, which we'll get to. That would be funny. Yeah.
So you just threw a fundraiser? Is this tax deductible, or what was the point of this party, Bruce?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And I love it. You know, really, if you think about it, and they did a lot of this on Batman 66. Bruce Wayne he did say he wasn't going to invite any of the Wayne Foundation people because he thought they'd be killed there. But he's inviting innocent people to a party where they're trying to entrap a known criminal who's a killer. And he's, let's bring all these innocent people in and set them up, you know. It's like, that's kind of irresponsible in some ways, too. I know that's an old trope, too. But if you think about it, it's like, let's get as many people in here as possible. It's like Superman not taking the fight out of Metropolis.
Right.
Like, for instance, in Man of Steel, you know, like not trying to take the fight away from a city when he's in the middle of a battle. You know,
yeah,
it's like, yeah, but this is premeditated. You're setting it up, you know, but it's like, yeah, it's kind of weird. But either way, they have the party, and there we see Gordon is dressed as a pirate, someone dressed as Frankenstein's monster, a guy dressed as a very Adam West-like Batman with sunglasses, or maybe it's a nod to Tom Fagan in Night of the Reaper.
I thought, the Halloween party, the Rutland, Vermont Halloween parade.
Yeah, it might be, because he might just supposed to be having glasses, because Tom Fagan had glasses, so... is that Felicity from the Omega Men, the cat lady, or is it she's supposed to be a poodle? I wasn't sure.
Like I knew it wasn't, but all I was thinking of was Hepzibah, the Starjammers skunk cat lady from X-Men.
Yes,
but I knew it wasn't going to be that.
Yes, yeah, that's good. That's a good point too. Yeah, it could be. Yeah, and then the raccoon mask looks exactly like the character raccoon that attacked young Roman an issue ago, so full circle. So, yeah. Which we'll see that he actually ends up wearing.
Oh, the one in the foreground, at the front of it?
Yeah. Yeah.
I thought that was a bat mask. I thought that was like another play on Batman. Like.
Oh, okay. I think it's supposed to be the rack, because it looks like he's got a mask.
Yeah, yeah, he does.
It's orange. Like, remember we talked about last raccoon?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, because that actually comes up later on in the issue.
Yeah, yeah. So then we get this kind of weird scene. What did you think about the Vicki Vale reveal?
For one thing, I wasn't really sure what the point of it was, but also, like, for the world's greatest detective, you don't recognize an ex-lover's body when she's just wearing a mask?
But she's been working out so much. You know, that's what it is. You know, it's like, I guess. I mean, it's not like, you know, it's a weird scene. I remember this was the thing with Mitch, that, you know, Vicky felt just so dejected by Bruce from the various, like, Selena and then Julia Pennyworth and all this, that she finally just like, okay, I'm going to show him, I'm going to be tough, I'm going to work out, which I applaud Mitch for doing something like that. That was, you know, probably something that wasn't like super common. Like that was an interesting angle to go with her. It seems a little forced now, especially the way they're like, what you mean by body, Bruce? You know, I've been working out, you know, it's just like this, like in the pose, she's all like, you know, she's got her hip cocked and Jane Fonda exercise and Let's Get Physical by Olivia Newton-John. And I mean, I'm not trying to make fun of it, but it's progressive in a way, but it's also the fact that she's doing it just to basically get back at a man isn't progressive either. It's like, it's not like she's doing it because she wants to, like, she's like, I'm going to do this for myself and it has nothing to do with you. It's like, no, I'm basically showing you I'm tough now. You can't walk all over me, you know, or I don't know. I don't know. Today it just reads kind of clunky.
It's very dated.
Yeah, it's very dated. And we get a character I did not remember, her boyfriend after Bruce, Bill Modell, who's dressed as a clown, a very sad clown. And the clown looks like Jason's pal Waldo, which is who I thought it was, who was a character that was showed up several times during the Jerry Conway Mensch run. So I thought it was him, but it's this forgotten Bill Modell character. So I said that Bullock looked like a baboon, but he kind of looks like a bear with the skinny long tail too. So I don't know. And he's crouched down like he's like actually trying to act like he's like some kind of critter. Tom Mandrake draws him kind of weird. I like the art in this otherwise, but I don't know what he's supposed to be. Maybe the listeners have got a better idea of what Bullock's supposed to be, but he's got a monkey like simian like tail, but I don't know. I
just want to follow this story where Bullock turns out to be a secret furry, where he goes to like hotel furry orgy parties or something like this. Like
the scene in The Shining.
Yeah. There's a thing in the show Community where the principal watches a video of like two people dressed as poodles doing that. He's like, I hope this doesn't awaken something in me.
And then Bullock just, you know, rips the mask off of Cersei, not knowing who she is, which is, you know.
You should never do that without consent, guys.
No, you should not.
Especially if you're at a con and it's a cosplayer. Cosplay does not equal consent. Don't rip their costume off.
No, don't touch them and don't rip their mask off or costume off. Yeah. And we see Cersei's face, and it's pretty horrific, but I think Mandrake does a good job of making it disturbing, but not like it's it. You feel sorry for her. You feel some pity for her. It's not like she's some monster underneath. She looks like somebody that's like, you know, disfigured. I mean, it's not. And I mean, I know Cersei wasn't a great person to begin with. Obviously, she went along with, you know, Roman killing his parents and things like that. But you know, you do feel pitiful for what, you know, pity for her for, you know, what was done to her. You know, despite the fact that, you know, she's, you know, very shallow, obviously a very shallow person. But yeah, I thought that, you know, they kept hitting at what her face looks like underneath. It could have been a lot more over the top, but I think keeping it where it still looks somewhat realistic is a good idea.
Yeah. Like, I mean, it's especially for a model, someone whose whole livelihood was based on her appearance, to be reduced to this kind of face is a tragic downfall. And it is, yeah, it's not an attractive place. It's very unpleasant, but it also doesn't look unbelievable. It's monstrous for a person in her mind, of her background, the way she kind of views herself and society, and that she would think of herself as a monster. We wouldn't say that, but it's also, this face isn't out of the realm of possibility. You know, like the way Two-Face is disfigurement, like, how is he not getting infections from that?
Right. Like Jim Carrey said in Batman Forever, if you pick at it, it'll never heal. You know, that type of, And especially, like, you know, I mean, the Nolan version of Two-Face, yeah, that's more realistic, but it's all, I mean, it's like, how would you not be dead? I mean,
yeah, he couldn't have survived that movie.
You couldn't have survived. I mean, it's a good thing he died at the end, because he wouldn't have survived. He would have got, like you said, some kind of septic infection, you know. So, yeah. Then we get where, you know, Sionis in the raccoon mask, acting like he's Stevens, asked to see Bruce's conservatory and his orchids. And then, of course, Alfred finds the real Marconi, he thought he was Marconi, I guess, yeah. I don't know who, he thought he was somebody else. Mm-hmm. But anyway, and he finds the guy, Marconi, he thought Marconi had the drama mask, I was right the first time, and he finds Stevens. I don't know if Stevens is dead or just knocked out, they never say. You know, they go out to the conservatory, and this is when Roman takes his mask off, pulls the gun, and Bruce kicks him and then punches him. So, you know, is this a little much for Bruce Wayne to do, or can we just assume that, you know, he, like, could any, like, if he had a minimum amount of, you know, training, he could do this and not be Batman? I just wonder if this is, like, you know, giving too much away. I don't know. What do you think?
I mean, it definitely doesn't appear to be, you know, a foppish playboy type of maneuver, but it's also not doing something extraordinary, especially if you're underestimating him. I mean, all he does is, like, kind of kick his arm and punch him and kind of get the drop on him because he wasn't expecting it. And I think Roman is even, he's like, yeah, I underestimated Bruce Wayne. But I mean, like, at some point, they've kind of copped to it, and especially going back to the current Matt Fraction run, where they're like, okay, yeah, he's a billionaire. He's, you know, it's kind of common knowledge that, yeah, he's trained himself in defense because he's a target. He would be a target. He's also, like, a great athlete because he has the time and the ability to, you know, do mountain climbing and fencing. And he can, so yeah, Bruce Wayne knows how to defend himself. So there is, like, yeah, it's not unbelievable. You know, it's not the same as him, like, cowering and, like, you know, crying and pretending like he's got an upset stomach like Clark Kent would do.
Yeah. I don't mind it when he does that, as long as it's not like he's giving away too much. You know, it's right. Not like in Batman, we get Batman Forever again, where, you know, Val Kilmer is Bruce Wayne's, like, kicking all the ass of the Two-Faces men in the circus. You know, it's like, and nobody notices that, you know. It's mm-hmm. like, and then, of course, later he does say he's Batman trying to get his attention, but anyway, yeah, I always drift off to the movies, I apologize. Mm-hmm. Of course, Bruce does pin himself under the statue so Gordon doesn't catch on, which is a nice touch. And then Robin emerges from Jason Todd's room. I'm not sure that's a good idea. Oddly enough, ties in a bit to our next comic. Just saying, different Robin, but same kind of problem. I noticed one thing, especially when we got to the Batman action. Do you think Mandrake has simplified his art style in this issue compared to the previous one? Because it seems much less scratchy and seems a little more DC house brand in some ways.
Yeah, I would have wondered if there was if a different inker took on this part, or if it was just rushed and he had to just. It definitely feels different.
Yeah, it does. I checked to see if there was another inker, but apparently he inked both the previous issue of Batman and this one, so part one and part three. So, yeah, I thought that was kind of interesting.
It wouldn't surprise me if somebody else came in and finished these pages uncredited, but, I mean, yeah, I don't know.
Many hands type thing. Yeah. Black Mask really tripped out the crypt, didn't he? I mean, I guess if you have stupid rich money, you can do what you like, make a false bottom in your parents' casket so you can escape down outside into your waiting hearse, which I think is a nice touch.
The Black Mask mobile is a hearse. I like that touch.
Yeah. But wasn't the Sionis estate already burned down? I mean, maybe it didn't completely burn or they rebuilt it, but we know he moved into the Janus building with Cersei because he told that guy to clear out that floor for him.
Right.
So it's like the way Mandrake, I went back and looked, the way he drew the fire in the previous issue looks like the whole thing's on fire. So, I mean, I guess they could have rebuilt it, but why would his childhood room wouldn't be there if they rebuilt it probably. So I don't know. It was just kind of a weird, they made such a big deal that they burned the house. You know, he burned the house down with them in it that, you know, I don't know. It was just kind of weird, but.
And I do like when he goes to the callback to that raccoon stuffed raccoon toy thing.
Yeah, it's there. Yeah, that I can't remember the name of the raccoon. He said it in the previous issue, but yeah. As Batman and Robin fight the goons, Black Mask says he failed at nothing, but when he tried to be Roman again, he let a weakling like Bruce Wayne defeat me. He didn't seem too weak to me there, Roman. But as we said, but yeah. So what did you think about his final act of burning his old toys and room? Does that make story sense, or does it just fit Minch's psychological breakdown of the character more than that?
So that was something that I found it interesting when he actually confronted Bruce when he was going to kill him. I know he had to kind of go undercover. He couldn't go as Black Mask. That was the whole way he kind of slipped into the party. But the fact that he confronted him unmasked as Roman, and I was like, I'm not sure if I buy that. It seems a little bit contradictory, especially as Batman was describing him as he believes that the Roman Sionis part of him is dead. He's killed that. He's completely Black Mask now. And then to confront Bruce as Roman seems a contradiction to that, as I said. But then maybe, I mean, as he comes back and he says, no, that was that was the last vestige of Roman and that part failed me. So now I have to destroy Roman. Although I thought I had destroyed Roman Sionis, but I hadn't. There was still a little bit left of him left, and I have to get rid of that, including making it so that there is no Roman underneath the mask. So I thought it was an interesting psychological choice and kind of fitting with the character at the end of it.
Okay. Yeah, I guess maybe that might be my problem, that he actually went and, like you said, he was Roman there at the party. He kind of had to be, but it's like, you know, why didn't he just do the old Batman trick of having his cowl underneath the disguise, you know, have his black mask underneath. If he wore the raccoon mask, for sure, he could have done it, right? It was a big giant, like you said, big furry mascot.
He should have had a Sionis mask over top of the black mask, over top of the Sionis face.
That, there you go. Yeah, like three masks. There you go. Just keep pulling them off. Yeah. Of course, Mitch likes his purple prose. He's a very, very flourishy writer. The door swings open on hell, and it is clear that Black Mask has slain only part of himself. For a moment, he stands purged of all humanity, a faceless, satanic master of flames. Then the mask crumbles. You know, so it's like, wow, that's, you know, that's some, I mean, it's good. I mean, I'm not like making fun of it or anything, but it's like, that's the kind of writing you don't get in comics nowadays, you know, because you don't get narration like that. It's all internal narration usually in comics nowadays. And like I said, nobody colors fire like Adrian Roy. I mean, it's those pages, it's all red and yellows and oranges and I like the poetic ending where he did succeed because his face is now a black mask. Although I don't think he would have hair. They show him having hair.
Yeah, that would be.
Yeah, I think that would be burned off. And I'm not sure his eyeballs would have survived, you know.
Right.
Or his nose, or, you know, he would have, like, he doesn't look like he's really burned. He looks like he's charred, but he was literally face down in flames. I don't think that's how, unfortunately, fire works on flesh, you know. But it works for the story, you know. It's fine. Like I said, it's a nice poetic ending. So, you know, we get the little bit with Cersei where she drops off her mask to Roman at Arkham. And actually, I had to look this up. I'm like, did Cersei ever reappear? She does. She resurfaces in a Two-Face story not too long after this in Batman 387 through 398 and Detective 563 through 564 toward the end of Minch's original run and the pre-crisis era, so shortly before Batman 400, where we started with Nightcast. And then she comes back when Minch revives Black Mask in Batman 484 or 45 in the 90s. So, yeah. So she does actually come back.
I just got to ask about the last sequence when she goes to Arkham and gives a mask. Because like, she asks to see Roman, and he's like, yeah, he's not. The guard is like, he's not up to facing visitors right now. If you were a guard at Arkham Asylum and a woman approached you wearing a mask and asked to see one of the inmates, would you be casual about that?
No, I don't think I would. I think I'd probably pull a gun on her and call for backup security. Tell Gordon to flash the bat signal. Get him over here right now. Yeah, yeah. And he just lets her walk out. Yeah.
This is like this security guard explains why there's a breakout at Arkham Asylum every 7 minutes.
Well, that's true. I mean, that's canonical, right? So... Yeah, that's why. I mean, yeah, a good point. Yeah, yeah. So what did you think of the overall Black Mask story?
There's stuff about it I like. There's stuff I think certain elements of it aren't as fleshed out or developed as they could be. As you pointed out, they definitely overpromise with who Black Mask is going to be and, like, the status of him. But as a visual, he's really cool. Of course, they end up changing his visual, and the modern version of him has much more of that skull-shaped mask, which is, on the one hand, the skull mask is not rare. It's not unique, but it is very striking. It is very attention-getting. So it's a cool look for the villain, making him just kind of like a gangster, the head of an organized crime type of thing, I think is interesting. It kind of puts him on a different footing, more like on the, like, he doesn't have the same kind of psychopathy as like Joker or the Riddler. He doesn't have this compulsion to do certain things. At the same time, if they had stuck with the gimmick of him putting masks on his victims or something like that and kind of being more of a solitary serial killer that way, I thought that could have been something a little dark and creepy and interesting. I don't know, there's a lot of promise with this character. Don't think he's probably met his full potential, but he's interesting, and I like the story overall as an introduction to a new villain for Batman.
Yeah, I'm pretty much everything you said. I think overall it's a good story. It's a good introduction. I don't, as I mentioned and you said, I don't know if he lived up to that insane potential, you know, that they're like, yeah, he's going to be as great as the Joker and Rachel Gould. Well, no, but, you know, he has, like we said, he has continued on. They've changed him a lot. I do think you're right. I think if he had been, you know, I guess in some way, Mr. Zsasz is kind of like that,
yeah.
You know, he in some ways has occupies that serial killer kind of, you know, motif in Batman. So I guess that makes sense. But yeah, it would have been interesting. I mean, I guess his look kind of screams gangster. I mean, he's got the pinstripe suit and a fedora. So, and then of course they got rid of that. He usually wears like a white suit and, you know, now, and he's got the black skull, which is that a mask or is that his face? I haven't kept up. I guess, I don't know if it's supposed to be his face now or if it's a mask or,
I think it's a thing. It's sort of like a Doctor Doom thing where it's like bonded to his face.
Okay.
It's not his actual skull. Like it is a mask, but I think he can't take it off, but I don't actually know.
Yeah. Appropriately enough, this comic included a insert for Mask, Mobile Armored Strike Command.
Nice.
Which was in several DC Comics of the time. And I actually, in my original copy I've got, I actually pulled it out. I pulled the insert out, which makes my comic worthless. Idiot. Yeah, but no. You and I were both fans of Mask, the toy, the animated series and things. But it's appropriate. Black Mask, all this stuff about masks. And what toy line did they promote in here? Mask.
Perfect.
Yeah, where illusion is the ultimate weapon. Yeah, so... Yeah. See their laser rays. Fire away. Yeah.
All right, folks. I think that tells you it's about time for us to take a promotional break.
Yep.
We'll play an advertisement or two and come back with our coverage of Batman and Robin Year 1, Issue 9. Stick around.
Dr. Fate.
Dr. Midnight.
Starman.
Johnny Quick.
Wildcat.
Power Girl.
The All-Star Squadron.
Firebrand.
Amazing Man.
Huntress.
Cyclone.
Sandman.
Mr. Terrific.
Stargirl.
Commander Steel.
Power
Seven
Man.
Soldiers of
Liberty.
Infinity Incorporated.
Those are just some of the celebrated and beloved heroes associated with Earth 2 and the Justice Society of America.
These daring mystery men and women banded together in 1940 to form the first super team in comics.
They inspired a decades-long legacy of heroes who would follow in their footsteps. And now they've inspired us to launch a new podcast.
Justice Society Presents, a new anthology on the Fire & Water Podcast Network featuring a variety of theme shows with different hosts celebrating some of their favorite comics and characters associated with the Golden Age of Comics, Earth 2, the JSA, and beyond.
We'll launch this new series with an ongoing show called Justice Society Presents Crisis, in which Rob and Shag go through each of the classic team-ups between the Justice League and the Justice Society.
Then joining the podcast feed will be the Starman Chronicles. Chris and Cindy continue their coverage of James Robinson's epic series from beginning to end.
Later in the year, Ryan Daly and Max Romero will tackle the Vertigo title Sandman Mystery Theater.
And 2 years later, Ryan will cancel it.
That's probably.
Then in the coming months and years, we'll be adding further ongoing shows and one-off specials celebrating other beloved characters in comics related to the JSA of any era, from the 1940s to today.
Join the fight for justice and subscribe to Justice Society Presents on the Fire & Water Podcast Network.
According to the latest report from falsifiedstats.com, 2.3 million new comic book podcasts are being created every single day. If you're looking for something a little different, then let me tell you about Mike's Comic Shop Roadshow. Mike travels the globe and visits comic shops along the way, like Murfreesboro, Illinois, and Liverpool, New South Wales, Australia. So check out Mike's Comic Shop Roadshow, a truly unique comic book podcast among billions of the same old, same old.
Batman and Robin Year 1 Number 9 came out on July 15th, 2025. The cover shows Batman and Robin in a shadowy, smoke-filled space surrounded by round red eyes, which are the night vision goggles of a mercenary special forces unit, but we don't know that yet. Thoughts, Chris?
I feel like Batman and Robin are surrounded by Batman the Animated Series Mr. Freeze cosplayers. But it's a beautiful cover, as always. But that's what it made me think of, you know.
It does. The red color, it looks exactly like that.
Yeah, I could just... Yeah, all these people are trying to do their Michael and Sarah, you know. It's like, I am dead inside, you know. That's, you know, it's like, you know. But no, it looks... I mean, it's a cool... Obviously, it's a cool cover. And I like the fact that Robin's, like, his eyes are, like, looking over his shoulder like, uh-oh, you know. So.
In the trade paperback, which I have in my hand... The cover they print in this one, I think might be like a second print or a third print because it's the same cover, but it's colored slightly differently. Robin's like flashlight at the bottom is more red. The smoke around them is a little bit more reddish purple, but the eyes, the light up eyes, are more yellowish orange than red.
Hmm. Well, that throws off the Mr. Freeze then. I don't like
exactly.
it.
Exactly. I mean, if somebody's following along with this book and they're reading that issue, then yeah. they're like, what are you talking about, Mr. Freeze?
Yeah. Okay.
So, just a little explanation.
We're not crazy, guys. It was red on the original cover. I've got the comic, so.
It's red on the digital cover. I'm looking at that one, too.
So. Oh, okay. All right.
All right. Chapter 9 is co-plotted by Mark Waid and Chris Samnee, with Waid scripting and Samnee drawing. Matt Lopez colored the issue, Clayton Cowles lettered it, and Andrew Marino and Rob Levin edited it. The Gotham crime families call for a 24-hour truce, during which they hire an elite Black Ops strike team to kill General Grimaldi. When the killers arrive at his hideout, however, they are ambushed by two hulking monster men. Grimaldi's biochemists have refined their experiments to create slightly more human monsters, though just as deadly. Batman and Robin arrive to fight the monster men, but Robin is distracted and nearly gets them blown up when one of the Black Ops guys detonates an explosive charge. Robin is sullen on the way back to the cave. Bruce and Alfred discuss their concerns that something is bothering Dick, but they don't know what. One of Grimaldi's henchmen makes a smart-ass comment, for which the general orders him to be taken to the lab and used as a test subject. Grimaldi then scolds Clayface for yet another failure in allowing Bruce Wayne's son to see through his disguise. Clayface comments that he thinks Wayne's son is adopted. Alfred finds Dick juggling tennis balls in his room. He has figured out the cause of Dick's dark mood lately. Today would have been his mother's birthday. Alfred notes that in all of Dick's flamboyant stunts and bravado, he's never seen the boy actually grieve for his parents. Robin snaps that performers don't cry and then breaks down, crying in Alfred's arms. Grimaldi is puzzled by Clayface's comment about Bruce Wayne's son. He recalls Robin using an unfamiliar word when he was Grimaldi's prisoner. A quick internet search reveals that the word Robin used is circus slang. Then Grimaldi remembers Bruce Wayne adopted a boy from the circus after his parents were killed. The general looks at the picture of Dick Grayson in the article and recognizes the face. He has figured out that Batman and Robin are Bruce Wayne and Dick Grayson. But if you thought that was the cliffhanger ending of this issue, buckle up, because Grimaldi is shockingly murdered by Clayface, who posed as his invalid father. Grimaldi falls forward, knocking over the police file and the computer he was using. The computer breaks on the floor, erasing the internet search and the secret of Batman and Robin's identity. Clayface impersonates Grimaldi so he and Two-Face can enact their plan to take over the general's operation. Alrighty, Chris, what'd you think about this shocking issue?
Well, I don't think Mark Waid has pulled a better twist since the reveal and the return of Barry Allen in the 90s. I mean, wow.
Good comp. Good comp.
Wow. I mean, it's like, holy cow. I mean, you know, and I know there's some controversy over this. Some people don't like that. I understand that don't like that. I've heard that. I think since we've been covering it, people are like, I didn't like the twist, you know, but I like it. I think Grimaldi was set up as such an infallible villain. It was kind of annoying in some ways, and I mean, he made some of the other villains look, you know, bad and look like they were, you know, really made Batman's foes look kind of weak, which made, you know, by extension, kind of makes Batman look weak to a point. So setting him up for a fall like this, in my opinion, was brilliant. And you never saw it coming. I mean, you never saw this coming. You just assumed that Mark Waid was trying to sell this Grimaldi, kind of like Doug Minch was trying to sell Black Mask. Oh, this guy's just as bad as all these other great Batman villains, right? It's like, nope, he's not.
I do remember thinking, I was like, okay, Batman and Robin don't kill, but I have a hard time believing Grimaldi will make it out of this story alive, because you're right, he's setting him up as this force of nature, that he's a better crime boss than any crime boss they've gone before, and he's more dangerous than any of Batman's real rogues, like Two-Face and Clayface and stuff. But this is in the past, and we've never heard of this guy since. I think that means he has to die, but you kind of expect that in issue 12, not issue 9.
Yeah.
And you're right about the fake out, the whole thing about the shock, the twist, is he does it twice in this issue. He does it in the beginning by saying, these guys are coming to kill Grimaldi. And when they show up, they're at the wrong spot. And he like, the dialogue is intercut, so you think Grimaldi is in the room where they're going. And then it's like the doors open, and it's like, oh, nope, different location. Grimaldi was in this other place. Those guys are ambushed by the Monster Men. So he plays that twist, and then at the end, Grimaldi still ends up dying in this same issue, just from a different twist.
It's kind of like when it leaked out in Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, that Spock died. And so they filmed the scene in the beginning with the Kobayashi Maru test where Spock dies, like a lot of the crew members in the test, but it's just fake. They're acting. And so you're like, oh, that's where Spock dies. He doesn't really die. And then they kill him at the end of the movie. So. Yeah, it's a heck of a move. And I always just kind of assumed when I was reading this that Grimaldi either, like you said, dies at the end or they think he dies. And then that sets Wade up to bring him back in a modern story, you know, like, oh, you know, it's been, you know, and he comes after, maybe then he figures out who Batman and Nightwing are, and he comes after them. Like, it's some kind of threat that Batman and Nightwing have to, you know, work together again. Not that they don't work together, but they have to work together specifically because it's a threat to them from their past or something. I thought that might be where they were going. Nope.
Right on page one, and again, like, this copy and repeat this sentence, this statement, Samnee's reverence and his homages to David Mazzucchelli's work in year one continues to be spot on. That little panel of Carmine the Roman Falcone, just the coloring in that this isn't just Samnee, this is Lopez the colorist too, but the shade of kind of bluish purple in behind the blinds, that looks right out of Miller and Mazzucchelli's year one. Like, that's the perfect color to be behind Carmine Falcone. Even, like, I think Tim Sale had the same color in The Long Halloween, too.
Yeah, you're right. In the little bit of pink on his skin to make his nose look redder, and, of course, he's got the scratches, you know. But, yeah, it does. It just looks like it could have come straight out of Batman year one, and that's not a bad thing at all. No, not at all.
I can't help this now, but the Black Ops guys, the Special Forces crew that the gangsters hire, which we're getting Angelo Baretti, Carmine Falcone, Edgar Giacomo, and Rupert Thorne. We get a Rupert Thorne appearance, and he looks very much like the Bruce Timm style Rupert Thorne.
Yeah, I can hear John Vernon's voice, which is, you know, it's about high time somebody put their foot down, and that foot is me, you know.
That foot is me. what I was going to say, though, the Special Forces guys in the bottom of that, the page two, that last panel, their mask with the yellow eyes and just like the shape of the mask over their nose and mouth, it reminds me of what is in the Court of Owls, their assassin, the Court of Owls.
Oh, yeah.
I think he's called the Talon.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Yeah, that from the New 52, the... That arc when the Court of Owls have like their one little assassin guy. I think he's called the Talon. That's what their mask looks like to me.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, it does remind me of that. There's something very And who knows? I mean, maybe they might set up some connection down the line or something. I don't think so because I think these guys are all massacred. But you know,
yeah. And again, great little twist and. In the beginning, Grimaldi is, you know, berating his father and, again, setting up, even though it's not his dad who gets him, but that reveal at the end is all the more poignant.
Yeah. That's the other thing. I mean, you just, you know, I don't know how horrible his dad was. You know, apparently he's obviously a very bad person. He's probably his own kind of monster. But the fact that Grimaldi just continues to treat him like he does makes you like, you know, you just want the old man, no matter what he did, to have some kind of, you know, agency to like trip him or something, you know, I mean, just even something simple like that. But it's like, so it's kind of satisfying when he dies by sort of kind of his hand.
I think Wade had to be taking something from the show Breaking Bad with this. Cause there's a character in that, like this old cartel leader named Hector Salamaca or something who, when we meet him, he's just like an invalid in a wheelchair. He can't speak. He's on oxygen. And they just have these like stories, like these nightmare stories about what a monster this guy was in life. But when at the time we see him, he's just like reduced to this. And that's kind of what I think of with Grimaldi and his dad. Like that, I think Wade was kind of going for something like that. Like whoever his dad was in a previous life was horrible to create Grimaldi the way he is.
Yeah.
But by the time we see him, it's the shell of that.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I'm sure you're probably right. I've not really ever watched Breaking Bad, but it sounds like something he definitely would, something that would work in integrating here. It kind of also reminds me a little bit of how they treated Bane in Batman Beyond. He was just an invalid in a wheelchair, you know, and they had taken the Venom and made it into those slappers that everybody was using, and you know, Terry had to fight all these roided out Bane-like guys, but the real Bane was like just this shell in this chair with an oxygen mask on, like all the damage he'd done to his body, bulking, venoming out over the years, had just left his body a wreck, you know.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I mean, it's not that, but it did kind of remind me of that. That you're probably more right. It's probably more the Breaking Bad thing, though. Yeah, I will say the monster man with the hair looks like actor Rondo Hatton, who appeared in a lot of Universal horror movies in the 40s, and the Rondo Horror Award is named after him. He actually suffered from acromegaly, so he actually looked like that. He had very, pronounced, elongated features, huge jaw and brow, and he was actually a very intelligent, had been a journalist, and he began to suffer from that, and he actually figured out, okay, I can make a living doing these horror movies, you know, and he made several, he died young, but yeah, he had a guy made up look like him in The Rocketeer. There was a guy in Batman the Animated Series who looked like him. Everybody likes to use Rondo Hatton as for this kind of big brutish, you know, cause he played the brute man in the Universal Pictures.
The character Jaws from the James Bond movies always kind of reminded me of that guy.
Yeah, yeah, he did. And I guess, you know, it's possible that, what's his name? I can't think of the actor's name that played Jaws. He played he was cast as the Hulk originally, and it didn't work out, and they recast Ferrigno. Richard Kiel. He might have, usually a lot of, when people are that large and have the pronounced features, they have some form of that acromegaly. Of course, Rondo had it severely, in this one.
I definitely see it. I think you're right. That guy, the brute, the monster man with the hair, it looks just like that guy.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, it's kind of like an inside baseball thing. Like only like geeks seem to know who he is. So it's like they use him wherever they can. they keep Rondo alive. Yeah. You know? So
when we get to the page where the explosions are going off, the room is covered in smoke, and Robin pops down, lands on one of the special ops guys. There's a third panel after he lands on him. There's like a third panel. It's a small, like, it's just like a shot of, like, part of, like, the ceiling or something, but I don't know what I'm supposed to be looking at in that panel.
Oh, yeah. I think it's Batman, like, over top of, like, in the smoke, his cape. Yeah.
Okay.
I think that's what it is, but that's kind of weird. In fact, I didn't know it was, because the panel borders are black, I thought it was all the same image, but you're right, the smoke doesn't continue. It would have made more sense to be one image.
Right, but yeah, it's clearly not the same. Like, the smoke is colored differently. It doesn't continue. It's definitely two different panels. And then it's funny, the next one is, like, Robin. He's, like, radioing back, and he's like, hey, the monster guys, I think they're headed your direction. And then they come out of the smoke reaching for Robin, and Batman's, like, wrong. And he's like, you don't have to sound so casual about it.
Yeah, I love that. I put that in my notes, too, yeah. There's a couple little bits in here. We've commented on that where he goes to really small panels, like when Batman throws the batarang on the next page and pulls the beam loose to hit the monster man. There's a couple things that are a little hard to read, and I think part of it is because everything, there is so much black. It's because the pages are always black, and you know, I think sometimes your eye gets a little. That's my one very minor, guys, super minor. I love the look of this book. I love Chris Samnee's art. So do not think we've got to every once in a while make a minor little complaint. There's a little trouble following the action here and there when he goes to these little tiny panels. And I think a part of it is because there is so much shadow. There's so much black, especially with all the smoke. And so it's kind of hard to make out exactly what's going on. But, you know, it only takes like I look at it again, then I get it. So, you know.
That page where he used the batarang to pull like the beam or whatever into the monster man's head, in the bottom left, there's a just a kind of a panel of Robin running as the monster is kind of staggering behind him. And there's no dialogue in that. And then the next panel right beside it is Robin kind of. And I was kind of wondering, I was like, that seems like an odd panel. Like, I don't know if that conveyed any new story information. Like, why did we need that panel? And then in the very next panel next to it, Batman is saying, "You're unusually quiet tonight," which for one thing is kind of funny. But also just like, I think like, yeah, the fact that there was no dialogue in that panel before, like Robin is doing, he's fighting and he's doing the action, but he kind of seems like he's a little bit on autopilot. Like he's not his usual self.
Yeah. Yeah. That it might be one of those cases where they co-plotted this together. They might've done it Marvel style and he drew an extra panel and Wade's like, "I don't know what to put here. So I just won't put anything."
Right.
You know, yeah. Cause he's not supposed to be very talkative. So if Robin's quips right here, then it kind of goes against Batman saying, "You're unusually quiet tonight," you know, so you know, that might be why he doesn't have any word balloon there, because it kind of seems like he should, you know, or at least the monster man should be going like he's hurt, you know, groaning or something. Yeah.
And then yeah, they're like, yep, Grimaldi's not here, because clearly that's what Robin is focused on. And then they just see one of the special ops guys who's still alive, although it doesn't look like he's in good shape. He's got a trail of blood behind him, blows up the warehouse. And you can just see the fire and the smoke from the distance of the cityscape.
Yeah. And apparently they don't get out completely unscathed because Robin's now got a burn on his arm. Yeah. And you think he's down because he looks very down, but you think he's down because he like screwed up, but he's not. We find out why later, of course, like you mentioned in the synopsis. So.
Yeah, and Batman clearly concerned. He knows something's wrong, but he doesn't know exactly what it is. And we'll get back to them in the Batcave in a second. But we cut to Grimaldi, and I gotta say, if you were a mob henchman or like an underboss or something, don't make smart-ass comments. It never works out.
No, I mean, he might be worse to his henchmen than the Joker. You know, at least he just pushes them in front of a truck or something.
Right.
You know, this guy's going to get experimented on and turned into a monster man, this Danny Kaye lookalike here. You know?
Yeah.
You know, it's do not be a smart ass to a Gotham crime boss. That's never going to end well, no matter who it is. But yeah.
They don't like people who can think for themselves.
Exactly, yeah.
And then he starts, you know, just ripping Clayface a new one. And I remember reading this the first time going, why is Clayface putting up with this?
Yeah, yeah, exactly, yeah.
Which, hold that thought, put a pin in that one.
Yeah. And I like how Clayface was just disguised as another goon, and then he turns into the version of Matt Hagen with the clay mask over top of his face with the little pencil thin mustache. Yeah. That's cool. So he's not advertising that Clayface is working for him to the other goons, which is, and also another great aspect of it, because I would probably have to go back and look. I think he's always been conversing with Clayface, just him, because that way the gang will never suspect that Clayface replaced him, because they don't know he was working for him, you know.
Oh, so, good point.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think, I have to go back and look at the previous issues, but I don't think he ever interacts with Clayface in his quote-unquote normal form or his monstrous, like, BTAS form, you know,
right,
around the other goons, around the gang, so.
Right, it's always one-on-one, so they don't know who
right.
Clayface is.
Right, right.
Nice. Oh, interesting catch, yeah. And then, yeah, he kind of like, yeah, no more mistakes, and he's like, yeah, he says dismissed. And Clayface is like, fine. He's like, oh, by the way, I don't think that's Wayne's son. I think he's adopted. And you just kind of get the shot of Grimaldi looking at the file.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which sets up, uh-oh. Yeah.
And then the Batmobile pulls into the cave and Alfred's coming down and Robin just kind of bolts up and doesn't want to talk about anything. And he's just like, yeah, good night. And Bruce is like, I'm turning in my detective school badge or my detective school diploma.
Yeah. That's cute. Yeah. And I like that, you know, of course, Alfred's going to, you know, look into it. And I do like on the next page, Sandy draws Robin's costume correctly. Like the vest is separate, goes over the green shirt. Sometimes it's one piece, the green shirt and the shorts. But that's actually how Burt Ward's Robin costume was made too, which that, you know, I like that. Yeah.
Yeah. The red part is like an outer layer, a secondary vest over top of the green shirt. It's not one piece.
Right. And it's not, the collar's not, it's part of the cape. It's not part of the tunic or the green, which I've seen people do that too, but it's like, I mean, you draw it how you want, but the purist in me says, this is what his costume looks like, you know, underneath the red vest. It's even how George Perez drew it when he actually like took all his Robin costume off in that Teen Titans issue when he quits being Robin, and Tara's like, ooh, take it all off. So, you know, I catch little nerdy things like that. You know, I can't.
That's why we love you.
Yeah, that's right.
So yeah, Alfred comes in and Dick is juggling. He's up to 7 tennis balls now, and he's keeping them afloat. He's keeping his focus as Alfred is trying to say hi. And then, of course, Alfred mentions that this was the day, or this would have been his mother's birthday. And boom, all of the balls fall to the floor because that broke Dick's concentration. And we get this really touching, heartwarming scene of Alfred trying to reach out to him and saying things like, you know, he mentions, you know, Bruce keeps everything bottled inside. Bruce is like, puts up a mask over everything. It's like, but Dick is different. Dick wears his emotions on his sleeve. He broadcasts how he's feeling all the time. But he's like, the one emotion that I haven't seen you display is grief. I haven't seen you actually mourning for your parents. And he's trying to reach out to him, and we get this beautiful little panel where you turn the page and it's Dick, and he's got tears welling up in his eyes and his face is all red and he's like screaming, performers don't cry. And Alfred is like shocked at this outburst from him, and just immediately Dick crumbles and just grabs him and starts crying into his arms, and the tenderness with which Alfred holds him. A really good scene, and you kind of, it's something that they talk about in all of the comics, but it's like, this is the scene that really kind of crystallizes it, that Alfred was a father to Dick and maybe Jason and Tim and Damien in a way that Alfred couldn't be for Bruce. Alfred wishes he was the kind of father for Bruce that would have made Bruce grow up to be a normal, well-adjusted person who doesn't go up to fight crime and dress like a Batman. He wishes he had been that influential, and he kind of let that down. But he's always had this more paternal instinct, and he's always known the right things to say when it comes to the Robins, Bruce's kids, the other kids. And I think part of it is a little bit of the first child thing, where parents, when they have the first kid, they don't know what the hell they're doing. Yeah. And when the second child comes along, it's like, okay, I know where I screwed up, so I can be better the second time around.
Yeah, it's like the first pancake kid, right?
Yeah.
Your first pancake doesn't come out good, but the second one's pretty good, right? You get the shape right. It's, you know, yeah, you burn the first one, right? Yeah, it's I think that's got a lot to do with it. He knows, because he's been through this with Bruce, it was totally unknown territory, you know.
Yeah.
And because also I think too, because, you know, and they've said that before, it's that Bruce didn't have the outlet that, I mean, he was training and all that stuff, but he didn't have, or starting to study and stuff, but he didn't have that physical outlet that the Robins have. You know, that's another reason, you know, but yeah, it's a lot of it's because of Alfred, because he became a better father after he, you know, after going through the trenches with Bruce. Yeah. And it's a beautiful moment. It's really well done. It's genuinely touching without being like overly schmaltzy, or, you know, it's really, and you know, and it can, as somebody, you know, not that I, you know, lost a parent in a extortion scheme in a circus when I was just a boy, but, you know, when you know, as somebody who lost a parent, you know, as a young adult, it's, you know, it's still kind of raw. I mean, you know, and this has just been a few months, you know, for Dick, and he hasn't, I mean, that's a good point. We've never seen him grieve through this. He's been, you know, the laughing young daredevil, the smart ass, the, you know, but it this day just got to him, and he was off his game, and it just took Alfred to figure it out. And then, you know, that hug is just what he needed. You know, it's a really wonderful moment. It makes you, I mean, obviously we care about these characters, but it makes you care about them that much more.
Right.
And worry about what's going to happen in the next page, you know, so.
Yeah. Yeah, in the next page, we're back in Grimaldi's office, and the first line of dialogue, he's like, "What's wrong, Papa? Where is that lingering smolder in your eye tonight?" He knows. It's like he's telling you right now, there's something different about his dad, but he doesn't think about it. He doesn't consider that his dad a threat. He never suspects. It's like he's picking up on something. He's like, there's something different about you, Dad, but he would never in a million years expect what's about to happen.
Yeah, he's even arrogant about it. You finally accepted that I am the better man. That must be it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So he's like, you know, he's so full of himself. It's just like he can't see past his own arrogance, you know.
Yeah.
So yeah.
And he's got his coffee and he sits down at his computer and he's like, yeah, he's like, something that Robin Bratt said when you had him hostage, like, tipped me off. He's like, I didn't think about it at the time. And he remembers a thing from issue 6. And he's like, when Robin said, "You think it's that simple? Batman's going to slough this whole place." And that line of dialogue is in that issue. I don't think we talked about it at the time.
I don't think we did either. Yeah. Yeah.
I think I completely forgot that was a tip off that came back later on.
No, I didn't think about it either. I don't remember even thinking at the time, thinking, well, what is that? That must just be some, you know, there's characters use words in comics that I don't know what they are. When I was a kid, I used to look them up. Sometimes I still do, but I, for whatever reason, I didn't that time. So, yeah.
So, and that's what Grimaldi does. He looks it up. He's like, what is that word? And when he finds out that it's circus slang, and he's like, hang on a second. He's kind of figuring it out. And he goes to the headline of the Gotham Gazette, "Circus Performers Die and Fall, Wayne Adopts Circus Orphan," and close-up shot of Dick Grayson in the paper, close-up of Grimaldi's eyes. He has made the connection. He is going to get them, except, turn the page, whack. We don't even get a sound effect. I was wrong to make that sound.
Yeah.
It's just a silent panel of what appears to be his dad standing up behind him and a giant blade going right through Grimaldi's heart.
Yeah. And even in that panel for a split second, you're like, if you didn't think it was Clayface, it's like, oh, his old man's been faking this the whole time and he's got a sword, you know?
Right. So,
you know, he just ran his son through. It was like, no, but I mean, I love the coloring in this. It's just all red. It's
yeah.
all one tone too. It's like, it's not shades of red. It's all like, it's all just Samnee's line shadow work and Lopez's red colors. Well, I guess the blade has a deeper shade of red. The blood is a deeper shade of red. It's fantastic. I mean, it is one of those jaw dropping. There's very few moments in comics where you're like, you know, this is one of those moments.
And Papa / Hagen just like whispers in his ear, "Dismiss that." And that's the tip off. It's like, oh, that's who it is. And then just you see the kind of a clay falling off him and he just throws the body down. We get the panel of the computer crashing to the floor. So taking the secret that he just discovered with him to the grave.
Yeah.
And then we back up enough to see the actual Grimaldi's dad dead on the ground, too.
Yeah, I'm surprised he didn't, like, have him hidden more, you know, because he couldn't see him when he came in. But, that's just for our purposes so we can see him. Yeah. Yeah.
He's kind of, like, changing back, and Two-Face is there. And, yeah, this whole thing is, they're kind of working together. And then we get a knock at the door, and Clayface goes to open it for one of his goons. And when he opens it, he's got Grimaldi's face. And he's like, yep, everything's fine. Nothing to see here. We're all fine now.
Yeah.
How are you?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I love the fact, you know, I've always thought as I was reading this, I mean, man, Two-Face is coming across as a chump in this story. He's got to get back on top at some point. Yeah, he did. Yeah. Yeah. Even more so than Clayface being a chump. I know he's more powerful, but Two-Face is, you know, he's one of Batman's top villains, obviously, you know, throughout his history, more or less. And so, you know, to see him treated like a second class villain compared to this new guy, you know, but it's like, nope, old Harvey was just biding his time, man. that's the Two-Face we know and hate, you know. Right. I do think it's interesting too. I meant to mention this. Dick says when he's talking to Alfred, right before he breaks down, he says, "Nothing to talk about. It happened. She and Dad died in a split second." He says that kind of in a whisper. And then who dies in a split second? Grimaldi.
Grimaldi.
And you didn't expect that, so.
Nope. I mean, this is probably an evergreen statement. We could say this out in every episode. Like, I think this might be the best written issue, just between the surprises and the shocking twists and everything, and that scene between Alfred and Dick. Maybe not. I mean, it's so hard to compare. But this just had, like, you know, two kind of back-to-back amazing scenes for different reasons.
Yeah.
Neither of which had Batman in them, but oh well.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I would agree. This probably is so far the best issue, like the best written issue, and certainly the most shocking issue. It's like, you know, so just one of those. I love it when stories can, you know, whether it be a movie or TV show or a comic, when a book, when they can legitimately surprise you and shock you with a twist or something that happens, or maybe it's a fist bumping moment, but it's just, it's one of those things, but it's out of nowhere, but it feels right. And that's hard to do, you know, because a lot of times when it's out of nowhere, you're like, oh, come on, man, really? You know, so no, some readers might feel that way about this. I don't know. I think I've heard rumblings that some people had a problem with, like, you set this guy up and then he just gets killed in like one panel. You know, it's like, but you know, it's you're in Gotham City. Welcome to Gotham City, Grimaldi. You know, there's a reason it's so dangerous, right? So you chose the worst city in the country to try to take over the, you know, the criminal empire. You couldn't have went to, you know, like, you know, St. Louis or Chicago, or, you know, I don't know if there's a criminal empire in St. Louis, but, you know, some place, you know, but now you had to choose Gotham City. You couldn't go to Hub City or Coast City or one of the other DC made up cities. You had to go to Gotham. So that's what you get, buddy.
All right, listeners, that is going to be it for this episode. We will be back in a month with some listener feedback and covering a different story. We're going to take another pause from Batman and Robin Year One before we race to the end, before the end of this year. And maybe that episode will have a fun little surprise for you guys. Maybe not. I can't promise anything.
Yeah, I hope that, you know, that Ryan doesn't have me killed, you know, on air, surprisingly, by a doppelganger or something. That would suck. But, you know, hopefully it's not that big of a surprise. But you never know, right? You never know. So
we'll see. If it happens, it'll be hilarious. Batman Nightcast is a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Feedback for this show can be left at fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can also find Batman Nightcast and the Fire and Water Podcast Network on Facebook, Blue Sky, and other social media platforms.
If you enjoyed this episode, please check out our Patreon at patreon.com/FWPodcast to support Batman Nightcast or your other favorite shows on the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
As always, thank you for listening. Wait for an invitation to